mom, you know, do you have a retirement account? I say, yes, you know, I'm investing my retirement. And we start talking about retirement account. She says she puts in 6%, the company gives her 6, you know, so on. Yeah. So, okay, cool. So, how about investing 1% in Bitcoin? I'm like, okay. She paused for a second. I'm like, oh, I guess. I was like, yes! Orange pill.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Foster Inclusion Podcast. And thank you so much for joining me. I'm your host, Saida Gomez-Thuri. This is the extended version of my Bitcoin in the Caribbean conversation with Rohan Smith, a software developer from Jamaica based in Scarborough, Tobago. If you've already listened to the edited episode and want to hear about our deep conversation about love and life, skip to the 50-minute mark. And if you're tuning in for the first time and you care about saving your money and maintaining purchasing power in the face of inflation, listen in. Rohan shares how he got into Bitcoin, provides a simplified analogy to understand why Bitcoin goes up in value with time, how to acquire Bitcoin in the Caribbean, and tips on what to expect if you are new to the space. He's also working on a tool to allow people in the Caribbean to acquire Bitcoin more easily and on a regular basis. If you're a legal or regulatory expert and you're interested in Bitcoin, reach out to Rohan on Twitter. His handle is at FrazRaz. That's FrazRaz. You can also connect with me at Foster Inclusion.
Right.
Rohan, how are you?
I'm doing awesome.
You're doing awesome. Yeah. Thanks so much for agreeing to be on my podcast.
Sure, no problem.
So you're in the U.S. now, getting ready to go to El Salvador, right?
I can't wait. It's been a while. I mean, waiting, but yeah, it's almost here.
I know. I'm so excited for you. When did you actually sign up for the conference?
I guess less than a month ago, just about a month ago, I signed up. I was in the early bird sign up, you know, so I got the best price. And you know, nice. I was really excited to get there.
Nice. And you fly out this evening or tomorrow?
I fly out on Monday. The conference starts
Monday.
That's the 15th, I believe. The conference starts on the 16th, so I'll be there the night before.
The night before. And I saw on Twitter that you're facing a bit of a dilemma, Jamaica versus El Salvador in the World Cup qualifiers.
Yeah. We've been rivals for a long time because Jamaica's in the same zone for the World Cup qualifying. So I like El Salvador, but I think I like Jamaica a little bit better.
Well, yeah. And that's actually a nice segue. Can you give us a brief introduction?
Right. So my name is Rohan Smith. I'm a Jamaican born, I guess, if I should label myself, software developer, entrepreneur. I currently live in Trinidad and Tobago.
In Scarborough.
Yes, Scarborough, Trinidad and Tobago. Tobago, there are two islands, so I'm in the small island, which is in Tobago, around the capital city of Scarborough. I'm a remote software developer, so my job is pretty much working on software projects, mostly in the US. I do mostly web development, so I work on these projects and from my small island home, close to the beach. Nice. So I get the best of both worlds, right? So and I've been doing that for perhaps past 12, 13 years. So yeah, that's I guess the general thing that I do, and you know I love Bitcoin. I've been around the space for a little while, and you know I fall in love with Bitcoin more and more every day.
Nice, you know, fun fact. So my family, both my parents are from Trinidad, Princess Town.
Okay.
And I grew up in Scarborough, but not Scarborough, Jamaica, Scarborough, Ontario, which is a suburb of Toronto.
So. All right. Yeah, my sister was in Scarborough for a while. So it was kind of funny that we were both in the same city in different countries.
Yep, totally. And Scarborough is known. Well, at least, so I'm not afraid or ashamed of revealing my age. I'm 43.
Oh, you don't look it.
Thank you. When I was, growing up in the 90s, dance hall was like, it was life. Everyone was into dance hall. Like, your parents could be from Sri Lanka, from the UK, from Trinidad, from wherever. Everyone was into dance hall. So I have like a soft spot in my heart for Jamaican music and Jamaican food.
Yes. Yeah. And it's the same here. When I moved to Trinidad and Tobago about 8 years ago, and I was shocked to realize that they play dancehall music perhaps more than I hear it in Jamaica. you know, there's soca and calypso that usually play around carnival time. But as soon as carnival is finished, they're back into reggae dancehall. And that was just like shocking to me. I thought Jamaicans were like the main consumers of dancehall. But I realized the Caribbean on a whole loves that type of music. So.
Even in Switzerland, I've like... this past summer, we went to like this, I guess, outdoor kind of concert festival thing. And like, there were like, I guess, two sound stages. And on the one side, it was like dance hall, 90s dance hall, and like Lover's Rock playing in Switzerland, in Geneva.
Yeah, there are a lot of reggae and dance hall artists who they can't make it in Jamaica because it's so competitive. So they tour Europe, and that's where they make their income, you know, because there's an audience in Europe for dancehall and reggae music. So I've heard of it. Mm-hmm.
Before COVID, Sizzla used to come through. I swear he was here like once a month.
Yeah.
I saw his posters everywhere. Mm-hmm. But we digress. I'm sorry. So how did you get into software development?
Right. So I think I was born with like a CPU somewhere in the back of my head. I just had an affinity to computers. Since I was a child, I didn't have a computer until very late actually, but I always just been curious about them. I think I got my first computer when I was about 13, 14, around that age. And when I got that, I just spent hours. I had no internet at some times, but I just go around and clicking around inside the computer in control panel and playing around with just curiosity just burned in my heart. And from that time, I knew that this is the career path that I'd like to go down. Because it wasn't work for me, it was fun. You know, I just like tinkering. And, you know, that just led me into the career that I'm in today.
Nice. That's that first exposure is so important, especially at a young age, because you don't have as much social pressure, so you really like see who you are and what you enjoy. So from software development, like how did you learn about Bitcoin, or what was your first exposure to that, and how did you fall down the rabbit hole?
Right. So I'm into tech. I just love everything tech, and I'm always like an early adopter. I try to, once a new tech comes out, you know, I'm onto it. I was on Twitter like 14 years ago. I'm just into whatever is new because I just like to see technology progress, right? And however, being in the Caribbean, you're not always on the cutting edge because the people around you are not always into technology as well. But we had a group, like a mailing list group, back in 2013 with a number of Caribbean web developers and developers in general. And somehow the Bitcoin came up on the mailing list. And, you know, and of course, once I hear about this new technology, I'm going to start to, you know, look into it. And from there, I just started researching, you know, what is this Bitcoin thing? How do you buy it? Where, you know, but it was for me just something new, something fun. I never understood the magnitude the gravity of what Bitcoin was at the time. It was just another new tech. And I of course jumped into it. I bought some Bitcoin. It was just nice to play with that. I could send Bitcoin to someone the next side of the world and they'd have instant money. At the time, you know, I looked into mining Bitcoin. By the time I learned about it, it was a bit too difficult to mine on my computer, but you know, I investigated all the different areas of Bitcoin at that time. And you know, it just seemed fun, and I have been going down the rabbit hole since then.
Wow, that's you were part of a mailing list, so that's good. I found, like, when I was first exposed to Bitcoin, I was the only one within my circle, so I spent a while just wondering if I'm crazy for, like, for seeing them. For me, it's more the social benefits that it brings about and, like, fixing money, basically. And so I would say that I wasn't so courageous as to be, like, open and vocal. I think I created my Twitter account in 2017 and, like, didn't tweet at all because I was too scared. So, but yeah. So in the Caribbean, like, what would you say is the sort of, like, macro context? Like, why would a technology like Bitcoin be useful for the everyday person?
Right. So when I first heard about Bitcoin, the first thing that hit my mind was remittances, right?
Yeah.
I don't know the exact percentage, but in Jamaica, one of the main sources of foreign exchange into the country is through remittance. We are huge on sending money back from the US and Europe back into Jamaica to support families and so on.
Yeah.
So it has become an enormous part of the economy. But we know that, you know, once you're using the traditional remittance services like Western Union, MoneyGram, so on, they take a chunk of your money, right? And you know, I've been a part of the, I've received remittance from overseas, and you know that they had to pay a certain fee to get money to you. So once I heard about the Bitcoin, I was like, hey, this is an awesome source of, you know, peer-to-peer remittance. And, you know, I started investigating down that avenue because I thought that was the most impactful for the Caribbean at the time, because not only Jamaica, there are a number of other Caribbean countries that depend on remittance. And that's where I kind of positioned Bitcoin as a solution for the Caribbean. And over time, I've seen where it can grow far beyond that. Just looking on commerce in general, a large population of the Caribbean is unbanked. And, you know, you pretty much have to carry on the cash with you wherever you go. And then there's, on the merchant side as well, is that there are merchants who want to do digital payments, but there's a lot of red tape and, you know, bureaucracy when it comes down to getting just a simple point of sale device. You know, it's hard for a typical person to do that. So I saw that as well for just to help commerce in general in Jamaica. And just seeing how Bitcoin would solve those problems just makes me very excited about the technology. And I'm looking forward to play some part in helping the Caribbean, adopt Bitcoin to aid in some of those solutions.
So earlier you talked about the mailing list that you were part of. Since the mailing list in 2013, what is the Bitcoin scene like in Jamaica, excuse me, or Trinidad, or even Tobago?
Right. So, funny enough, that mailing list kind of petered out after a few years. As people transitioned to social media, I didn't see as much talk around Bitcoin, but I still was kind of playing around with it. In fact, the story with my first purchase is that I tried to figure out what Bitcoin was, and then I decided I'd purchase some. At the time, I purchased, I think, $150 worth of Bitcoin. And Bitcoin at the time was worth $300, right? And, you know, as Bitcoin does, its money go up technology, it went up 100%. And the price went up to $600. And I was like, I have $300. And I invested $150 and I now I have $300, right? And I was like, wow, this is so amazing. And then a guy said, you know, do you have any Bitcoin? I need some Bitcoin to buy. It's like, hey, what? I made 100%. That is awesome. I'm going to sell this guy. And I sold him my Bitcoin. I made 100% profit. And I felt like the happiest guy ever. Right?
Yeah. The smartest man in the world.
Exactly, right? And I sat with an empty wallet and I watched Bitcoin go up to 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, all the way up to $19,000. And I had zero. And I just depressed. I was sad. I don't know what words I had. I just kept on calculating and saying, you know, how much money would I have now if I just left that money in my wallet? And of course, as Bitcoin does, it crashes. And we know that great crash in 2017.
Yeah.
And it went all the way down to, I think, like $3,000. And I started just doing more research and investigating about what this technology really was. Will it die? I mean, for something to fall from $19,000 to $3,000, that seems volatile and like something's wrong with this. But then as I started to investigate further and further, I started to see the fundamentals behind Bitcoin. I started learning about scarcity, you know, the decentralization, started to learn, you know, the impact it's having in countries. Because I think at that time, Venezuela was jumping in on Bitcoin. Because the Venezuelan Bolivar, I think, started to, you know, devalued, and Venezuelans had to find a way to hold on to their property. So a lot of people were converting their bolivars to Bitcoin. And they were inflating and deflating in opposite directions, right? There was hyperinflation for bolivars and Bitcoin was hyperdeflation, right? And it's, I started seeing how its effectiveness in other regions and saying, you know, this technology seems like it's making sense. Even though at the point it didn't return to its $19,000 price point, I was seeing value beyond the actual price of Bitcoin. And interesting how I started going back into Bitcoin. A friend of mine, you know, we started working on a company, online company, to sell proxies like VPNs, right?
Yeah.
No, people who buy VPNs are people who want some amount of anonymity and, you know, they want to be outside of the system. So they've kept on asking for options to pay in Bitcoin. I was like, okay, sure.
Sure.
Right. So I hooked up a Bitcoin payment on our system and they started paying us in Bitcoin. And every month I'd, you know, take profits from the business and to cover my bills and expenses and whatever. And, but something just said, don't spend the Bitcoin, keep it. So I just like, okay, I'll put the Bitcoin away, whatever. I just kept, you know, putting away the Bitcoin. And I kept on learning more and more about it. And then I realized, hey, I don't really want to spend this at all. You know, and, you know, the company just kept on earning and I kept on putting, huddling my Bitcoin. And as it started to accumulate, I started to say, you know, it's time for me to understand this a bit more. So I started going out and learning more and more about it. And, you know, the more I learned is the more I wanted. Right? Yeah. And, you know, I just kept on accumulating as much as I could. The business ended up, we closed it on. And so I lost that source of Bitcoin, but I started purchasing, with my own, income. And, you know, towards my Bitcoin stash, as they say. So that has been my experience. And I've seen the price shot up from 3,000. And at today's date, I think the last time I checked, we're at about 62, 63, around there. So yeah, it's been a wild ride.
It has. And it's like, the thing I like about your story is that even though you sold because you were happy, you took profit, you were happy, you sold, you didn't stay bitter. And you had like the perfect reopening to Bitcoin by accepting Bitcoin as payment for your services. I know of a guy who in 2017, he was levered, highly levered, and the price shot up, it crashed, he got wrecked. And even up to today, if I speak to him about it, he does not want to hear the word Bitcoin. Like,
yeah.
Because, and that's the thing, like, I find that if you're too greedy,
yeah,
you're not going to make it.
Not at all, NGM.
You're not going to make it. Like, this sense of humility and, like, almost like the hustle mentality of trying to figure things out, and you provide a service, someone needs to be anonymous, okay, whatever, you know, like, that seems to be, or that seems to have been the way to, like, really get into the game. Now, I think it's changing a little bit, because it seems like Bitcoin is becoming a bit corporate, in my opinion, but...
Yep. Yeah, it's changing. It's funny enough, I thought it was getting corporate back in the day, because I when I got in 2013, I was all about mining. I need to start mining some Bitcoins. I had my computer at the time. I didn't have any miners and whatever. But when you check the forums, they'd say, hey, it makes no sense to use a computer to mine Bitcoins anymore. It's just, Bitcoin is beyond what a computer can. So it's, they're saying the corporate people are now in, and you know, the millionaires are buying up these big ASIC miners, and it's squeezing out the small man. So, you know, I had a bit of bitterness about Bitcoin in the early days. So I did feel that, but you realize it's not that, you know, there are people who started out as hobbyists, and they became those big people who are.
Yeah.
I think it's multi-million dollar miners. So.
Yeah, totally. And so how does your family feel about Bitcoin? Well, actually, maybe back up, because you said that you're always an early adopter. How has your family and friends reacted to you, like, bringing home these new tech ideas?
So it's funny. So I'm in the U.S. now. My mom lives in the U.S. And so yesterday, I you know, I've always been, you know, teasing her. Not teasing, just like... talking about Bitcoin in general. She knows I'm going to the Bitcoin conference, you know. So yesterday I kind of, you know, came and said, Mom, you know, do you have a retirement account? I said, yes, you know, I'm investing my retirement. And we start talking about retirement account. She says she puts in 6%, the company gives her 6, you know, so on. Yeah. So I was like, okay, cool. So, how about investing 1% in Bitcoin? I'm like, okay. She paused for a second. I'm like, oh, I guess. I was like, yes! Orange pill.
That was easy.
Because I framed it, because I'm saying if she's doing 6% in her retirement, then having a 1% in Bitcoin, that shouldn't be, you know, it sounds smaller, right? So it's a kind of, you know, ambushed her a bit. But yeah, she's like, yeah, I guess that doesn't sound too bad. I tried to up it to 3%, but she's like, eh, wait, no, not yet. But I got her to commit to doing DCA in Bitcoin 1% every month. So that's good news for my family. And they know that I'm into technology, and you know, I'm not just like in there fancifully. I do my research. I understand what I'm doing. And they know I invest in Bitcoin as well. So they see it as something that they don't understand, but they think I've done enough work for it not to be like a scam or something.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to educate them. I've gotten a couple of friends, Orange Pill, they're buying Bitcoin. I think my sister's should be starting soon as well. So it, people are, you know, they're seeing not only what I'm seeing, but they're seeing what's happening in the just general space. And media is starting to talk about it more openly. They're finding that, you know, billionaires are signing up to it and so on. So there must be something in there, but they just don't understand it as much as yet.
Yeah, there's less FUD. I actually, my sister has a publication called L3 Magazine, and she also works with VP Records in New York. And so I said, you know, since I finally got someone from Jamaica on my podcast, do you have any questions? And like for herself and also for her audience. And so she asked, explain, like you were talking to a baby, how does a person acquire Bitcoin? The easiest, most simple way to get Bitcoin.
Okay. So Bitcoin is like, okay, let me think about this a bit. Think of Bitcoin as a kid, you know, they're toys, right? However, like collectibles. Say, okay, I was in Pokemon, right? So they're Pokemon toys, right? Pokemon cards. And you, a couple of years ago, they printed perhaps a couple hundred thousand Pokemon cards, right? And they're no longer printing Pokemon cards. So whatever number of Pokemon cards are there, that's the only one that's left. Now, Pokemon card, because they've gotten rare, the value in them have gone up.
So limited supply. The supply is capped.
Yeah, the company that printed Pokemon cards, they're no longer printing cards, you know. Or if they're printing cards, it might be some newer set of Pokemons from 150 up. But the original Pokemon cards, if you own those are classics, right? So what happens is that more and more people are starting to learn about Pokemon. Even people who weren't born when Pokemon came out. And they, you know, this sounds like a nice classic piece to own. A part of the early 2000s, you know. And as more and more people learn about it, then more and more people want some, right? However, there's a limited supply. So if I love my Pokemon card and I have a Charizard, which is a rare holographic Charizard card, in order for me to give it up, you have to give me something of equal value. And money is something I guess we all consider to be a bearer of value. So less and less people want to sell theirs, the price of mine will go up. Right? And I know that price will remain up because they won't be printing any more Pokemon cards, right? And later on down in time, if I choose to, I can sell the Pokemon cards that I purchase for probably an even higher price as the rarity goes up. And it's holding its value over time. And if I choose to travel to the US or China, you know, I still have a market for my Pokemon cards because it keeps its value over space. And, I guess those are simple ways. And I guess because now it has value, I can perhaps do transactions. So if you have a PS2 I want to purchase, three Pokemon cards, a Charizard, a Pikachu, a Dugtrio, and that's worth the price of a PS2. And I get value for holding onto my cards for as long as I can afford to. So I think that's a kind of simple way if you're into Pokemon.
A limited supply.
Yeah.
So
right.
So I don't have any Pokemon cards whatsoever.
Right.
And I would like to get a Pokemon card.
Mm-hmm.
How would I do that? Would I go to... So I met you on Twitter, thanks to Cal Casa from Bitcoin Burr and Bitcoin NACFA. And so would I say, oh, you know, Rohan, I hear Pokemon cards are amazing. You know, the cost of living is going up. And I understand that the value of Pokemon cards will probably go up higher than the cost of living. So I would like to get a Pokemon card. Satoshi, we'll say.
Right.
So how would I do that? in the Caribbean specifically. Would I go to an exchange that's like hosted in the US, or how would I do that?
Right. So there are a number of ways. The simplest way is find someone else who has Pokemon cards and would rather to have money instead of Pokemon cards, right? So if you can bid, be the highest bidder. I mean, if I have the card, and you know, I like it, but I need to buy some food, right?
Yeah.
And this, I can't eat the Pokemon cards, right? You need to transact it in some way. So you find people who are willing to let go of it, and you bid a suitable price, and it might be higher than the market price, but it's accessible. So just like that, that's similar to Bitcoin. You find people who, there are people live there who have their Bitcoin, and you know, just like me, when I had my half a Bitcoin, you know, I thought making 100% on it was awesome.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people who are in the place where I am right now, where I was that back then, you know, so.
Yeah.
So there will always be a market for sale, peer-to-peer market. Now, there are also organizations who realize there's a market for it, and they accumulate as much as they can, and then they sell. Right, and they sell, of course, for a profit as well, but because they have so much and you know, and they're in the business of selling, they can give away the Bitcoin because they perhaps acquire more to sell, and these are what we call exchanges, and there are a couple of exchanges that are accessible to Caribbean people. There are some restrictions from certain banks and certain credit cards, but I found that there are certain banks and credit cards that do allow you to purchase from certain exchanges overseas. For the Caribbean, I know CEX is one that's very popular.
So
you can use a credit card, go there and purchase as much as you want, as much as the bank allows you. Until the restrictions start to come in, because I know I read Nigerian banks have started to put on restrictions on buying Bitcoin in Nigeria.
A
couple of other countries. But so far in the Caribbean, we're still kind of new, so I don't know if they hate it enough as yet or if they'll embrace it. So we can purchase through exchanges right now. So that's, I guess, the simplest way to get it acquired at this point.
And let's say I don't have a bank account, and I live in Trinidad or Jamaica or St. Kitts and Nevis. You would say then that I would opt for the peer-to-peer option?
Right. So peer-to-peer, there are always people there willing to Bitcoin arbitrage. They get it at a low price and sell it at a higher price. So just ask around and you'll find somebody. Trust me. They're not all of them are like public that they sell or whatever. But once you just start asking people, you know, you'll end up finding somebody who sells Bitcoin close to you. It's generally at a premium, but what I've always told people that, you know, Bitcoin goes up so much that get Bitcoin at a premium, and because you'll earn that money over time. Whatever you lost in that exchange, you'll get it back over time. You know, just because if you go in Bitcoin thinking long term, thinking that, you know, the aim is not just to make 100%. The aim is to own piece of the most valuable real estate on earth.
Yeah.
Your aim is not just to make 100% and sell. It's a long term investment. And
yep.
You know, if you do sell, it's gonna be on something that you really value. Some personal investment, or you know, you're not going to sell Bitcoin to invest in something else. You know, you're going to sell Bitcoin for you know, bettering your life in some way or the other.
Low time preference. That's after I read the Bitcoin
Standard by 16.
Yeah. And he spelt out the concept of low time preference. I was like, oh my gosh, excuse me. Oh dear. I was like, that's what my father has been trying to explain to me for my whole life. You know, like this notion of, cause like, I used to think my parents were just cheap, you know, like tight fisted. They would never spend money on like fast food, just junk or fiat food kind of thing. And, And so, like, when I was in university and I traveled and I met people who were more fluid with things, you know, I thought, you know, I must have grown up in this, like, like in this, like, extraordinary, like, unfortunate circumstance, because they would not let go of their money. Like, I won't tell too many stories about my dad. He's not here to counter, but yeah, I had some embarrassing moments as a kid. Like, the man refused to buy a car and took the bus, and he was a teacher at the same school as me. So it was embarrassing. I'd be on the bus with my dad going to school. Like, but anyways, so fast forward, I read about low time preference and I'm like, oh my God, I get it. I understand. And so, like, I wonder in the Caribbean if sort of like a low time preference mentality were to sink in, or were to, like, just spread, how that could change culture.
Yeah. You know, when I came into Bitcoin taught me a lot, more than just about, you know, digital currency and whatever. I learned about investment, and that low time preference thing is, like, one of the big ones. Because, and what I've learned about a lot of people who were, like, in the early days of Bitcoin, you know, they had 1,000 Bitcoins and, you know, they just spent it on whatever, you know, they made 100% and they sold all 1,000 Bitcoins. I've heard, like, tons of stories like that. And, you know, the reason I sold it, because I thought, hey, I'd make $100, you know, so I can use it to spend on something else. And what I never understood what investment was, you know, investment. My mantra on investment now is, when you invest with the mindset of never selling. I'm a big fan of Michael Saylor, and he asks this question: if you were to have bought real estate in Manhattan in 1900, when was the best time to sell it? Yeah, you know, was it 1930, 1950, last year when real estate prices shot up? It's never, right? Because it will keep on going up. Manhattan is just the most expensive square feet in the US. It's just an expensive real estate that will just keep on going up. Instead of spending it, you find ways to leverage it and use it to earn money, or you borrow against it or something, but you don't do it to sell it, right? Because it's just limited, it's scarce, it's valuable, and it keeps on going up, right? And when you think about investment in that sense, your time preference just automatically goes up. You know, you don't think of, you know, how can I make a quick buck? How can I get rich quick? Yeah. And a lot of people look at Bitcoin as this get rich quick scheme, and a lot of those people who are the ones who lose a lot of money. You know, you try to buy at the top and sell at the bottom, and you know it never works.
Yeah, that's what they end up doing: buy the top, sell the bottom. Right. I think I was lucky because I grew up with these concepts. I just wasn't mature enough to actually, I opened my first savings account when I was 16. I worked at a call center, and when I was 16, one of my, like, many after school jobs, and there was this guy, I wish I remembered his name, but he was like, who do you bank with? So I told him the name of my bank, and he was like, you know, if you open an account with, I think it was like ING, it was called ING back then, they'll give you, like, I don't know, 5% interest. And at the time, because I'm 43, when I was 16, that was like a big deal, you know? Right. So I'd get paid like every 2 weeks, and I used to write myself checks for like $50, right, and just put it in the savings account. Just put it. And I actually still have that account today. Yes. So, like, decades. And I've seen, like, I've got, like, data, okay, to see how the interest rate has decreased with time. And not just that, the fees have increased. Yep. So I've seen money just, like, disappear. Mm-hmm. I pretty much drained that account to buy Bitcoin. I left just a little bit in there, you know, because you never know one day if I go back to Canada or whatever. But that, like, that sort of savings mentality has always been with me. But just with time, I've been like, what's the point? Interest rates are so low. They're negative in some instances. There's so many banking fees. Like, what do you do with your money? You buy a home, and what do? Like, most people can't afford to have, you know, property in Manhattan. Most people can't afford to have property in Switzerland. Most people can't afford to have property anywhere. So how do you acquire property rights that you can hold on to, pass down from one generation to another, and leverage, as you were mentioning? And like, for me, Bitcoin is just like the perfect solution.
Yeah, and there are people who in the Caribbean who have low time preference. I mean, you've heard of stories of people who are, you know, like lowly farmers, or they operate taxis or whatever, you know, menial job, and they'd send 3-4 kids to university, all right? And you wonder,
yeah,
where did they get this money from? And
yeah,
and all they did was save.
Yeah.
And they understood the importance of saving, right? However, we're now in a time where saving makes no sense, right? You put your the traditional savings account, you put your money in it, and you get 0.2%. It's ridiculous, right? And it's making, I mean, they're doing what they need to do in terms of putting away their money every month or whatever, but the returns, that they're getting lesser returns than what my grandparents would have gotten in their savings account, right? So what they need to do now, they're forced to learn about stocks and investment in stock markets and real estate and so on, when all you want to do is to put down your money, right?
Yeah,
I read this article. It's the Bitcoin is a great definancializer, right? It destroys the need for the financial market, right? You don't need to know about stocks and PE and, you know, all the crazy financial terms that people throw around. You just put your money in Bitcoin and save towards your goal, just like regular savings account used to allow us to do, right? You don't need to pay a manager. You don't need to pay any fees. You just save every day. You put a donut. If you're a single mother with 5 children and you're earning minimum wage, you say, okay, I'm earning $12 an hour. Let me put down 50 cents, right?
Yeah.
You choose what you're capable of managing, right? Bitcoin is not pro rich, right? You don't have to have a whole Bitcoin. You can save as one Satoshi, right?
Yeah.
And you put it down over time, and Bitcoin reward you over time, and that's what I just love about it. It doesn't discriminate rich or poor. It rewards everybody in the same way. The same percentage that Michael Saylor or whoever billionaire Bitcoiner gets, the same percentage I get. You know, it's fair across the board. And we all benefit in the same way. Once we do, we save, we dollar cost average and huddle, right? So that's what I really love about Bitcoin, as you know, just the principle that supports it and what it does in terms of building wealth and allowing us to invest our hard earned fiat into something that will grow over time.
Yeah. I'm such a, like, I don't know, I'm super goofy in general. And when something, like, when I have a soft spot for something, I just become even more goofy. And for me, like, just knowing that this thing, this technology, this software exists that can grant, I say equal access, but we do need to have like an internet connection, or a satellite hookup or something.
Mm-hmm.
But provided that people in various regions of the world have that and they have a willingness to learn, they can access this information. They can learn about it. They can set aside, as you said, like one Satoshi, and they will be treated equally. Like, I can't believe that in my lifetime this thing exists. I feel like we are the luckiest people in the world to be living through this right now.
Yeah, it's like the beginning of a revolution. You know, I always tell people, you know, it's like you are born before the Industrial Revolution, right before you are pulling things with oxen and horses, and then you sleep and you wake back up and there's a machine outside plowing your farms. You know, it's a switch. And the difference with this revolution is that it's going to happen way faster than any of the other revolutions, right? It's going to blow us away, like, before we even realize it. You know, I saw a picture. I can't remember the exact dates, but they were showing New York City. I think it was Manhattan. At one point in the I think it's early 1900s. And when you looked at the picture, it was horses traveling down the street, pulling carts and so on. And 10 years later, that street was transformed to only cars.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it blows your mind as to how quickly an entire industry just gets switched over when you have technology coming in and just changing the entire system. You know, and I think the same thing's going to happen with Bitcoin. You know, it has been a bit latent for the past couple of years, but it's reaching this tipping point now where, you know, the whole bucket is pouring over and you know, you can't stop it. I mean, it's too big now to stop. You know, it's a snowball that has, you know, gathered steam over time and it's rolling down the hill now. No, it's at the point where you can't stop the snowball because of an avalanche. So you just have to surf it. You know, jump on your surfboard and you ski over it, yep. Or surf over it, and you move along with the wave, you know, and you get the best if you try to do that. So, you know, I'm just looking forward to it. I guess I'm 35, so I'm still young. I have a bit more years, I guess, unless you're a centurion. But I'm 35 and I'm vegetarian, so hopefully I get to see a lot more.
I didn't know you're vegetarian. There's Bitcoin vegan as well.
Yeah,
she just released a book.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
So okay, I didn't know this. So how? This is fascinating because I know that, like, so Saifedean, author of the Bitcoin Standard, and many other Bitcoiners are advocating for the carnivore diet. Yeah. A lot of meat. I tried being vegetarian a few years ago for like a month and my nails started to break, my hair started to fall out. I'm a meat eater. I apologize for the vegetarians out there. But I need meat to survive. I thrive when I eat meat. So how, like, I guess from like kind of like maybe an ideological perspective, like how does it work to be a vegan amongst so many carnivores?
No, I actually think it's very funny. but I came into, well, I'm not totally vegan yet. I think I'm like 90-95% there. I've cut out like most dairy and eggs, but I won't read the ingredients on a container to see if it had dairy, you know. Like I prefer plant-based products, but I guess I'm just not like 100%. So I don't call myself a vegan, but I'm pretty much a vegan. But so how I look at Bitcoin, the same way I got into vegetarianism, I researched it. I figured out, okay, I looked at the impact it's having on the world. I looked at the impact it's having on me. And I just came to the point where I realized, hey, this just only seemed the only sensible way to go, right? And I do understand that there, because of the culture we grew up in, you know, our taste is towards meat. I mean, I grew up for 16 years of my life eating meat. So when I was in high school, I decided I'd switch over. And I've heard of people who had bad experience. I was a horrible vegetarian when I started, you know. My idea of vegetarianism was I just eat anything that's not meat, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So I had a horrible diet. But as you get educated, my investment thesis on Bitcoin is that invest as much as you know, right? Invest as much as you understand.
That's excellent. Right? Yeah.
And that's the same thing that happened to me for my whole health lifestyle as well, is that as I learned more and more, I started to drop out things because I became vegetarian, but as I call it pescatarian vegetarian.
So you ate fish.
Right, I ate fish. But then I started reading more, like, hey, why am I eating fish? This is not a vegetable. Right? I started watching different documentaries. Recently, the one that came out, is that documentary on this Seaspiracy. Oh gosh, that one just like hammered the nail in the coffin for me. And you see, like, you're destroying the oceans. I'm more of a nutrition vegetarian, so I'm more of, you know, getting my nutrition. I'm lesser on the animal rights part. I respect it and so on, but that's not my main reason. I look at nutrition and I analyze my nutritional needs. And for example, you said your nails started to get messed up and so on. My immediate response to that would be, okay, what am I missing? Is it that I'm not getting enough calcium? What vegetable has calcium? Yeah. What plant has calcium? I need to eat more of that, you know. Okay, I need B12. Why am I not getting B12? Okay. We're in a sanitized society. You know, we don't no longer drink from the streams. All right. So, okay, that means I need to get some supplements for that, you know. Fish is important. Okay. Why is fish important? There's omega-3s. Where do fish get their omega-3s from? Okay. They get it from seaweed or from other plants. You know, animals are really secondary. We're eating secondary nutrients. We never eat from animals. Animals have to get their nutrients from somewhere. So I find where they get their nutrients from. So now to get my omega-3s, I eat flaxseed every day. You know, I follow people who know what they're talking about. There's this website called nutritionfacts.org. They use scientific research to show you that, hey, a whole food plant-based diet is the best diet. And, you know, whatever you need, you can get it from plants. Right? You might be in a environment or a culture where flaxseed is not a common part of your diet, right? So you need to switch it up. You need to, okay, add this to my diet to ensure I'm getting all the nutrition I need. And the results are there. I mean, some of the longest living people in the world are vegan or vegetarian. You know, and the closer you get to vegan, the longer you live. The science is there to prove it.
Isn't there a village in Japan or something?
Yeah, Okinawa.
They eat a lot of, is it root vegetables or something? Or
right, there are blue zones across the world. There where they have a large number of centurions. Okinawa in Japan, I think, is one of them. And another group, which is in America, Seventh-day Adventists. I'm actually Seventh-day Adventist too. So I get influence from there. And in America, they are the highest, longest living group of people because of their diet. Well, diet is just one thing, and diet and just general, keep Sabbath, so you're resting on one point. So you get your rest in this fast-paced world. So before I make a decision on doing anything, I do my research. I mean, I figure out, okay, what are the benefits of this, and, you know, how will this impact me in the long run, and how are other people benefiting from it, you know? And I try to make logical decisions when it comes down to making these choices. And so far, so good. I haven't been to the hospital for anything in a while.
A touch wood.
Outside of like giving blood or something. But it's been good.
And how long have you been vegetarian now?
Since I've been 16, so that's perhaps about...
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, 35 minus 16.
So it's, 60, 40s, 14, 30, Lord, 19 years now?
I'm better, I like math in it, but I'm better at, like complicated math. Just general algebra and general arithmetic, I struggle at that.
Like Einstein, you're like,
I can do differential equations, I can do, you know, multiply 13 by 7. Like, what? Yeah.
I hear that for real. That's fascinating. I guess you know, like, so I guess I'm going to share one of my biases with you. When I think of vegetarianism today, I really think of manufactured products.
Okay.
Like Beyond Meat, like factory made vegetarian food. And so my position is, why would it be healthier for me to consume something that's been basically processed?
I agree.
When not too far from me, I can see, literally, I see where cows are grazing.
Or do you?
Where, yeah, where they'll be, yeah, slaughtered. And I know that I'm like, I have confidence in the local sellers that that's what I'll be eating eventually. So for me, it's like, why would I opt for something that's been processed when I can have something that is like, that is local to this land?
And I totally agree. Like whenever I eat those like Beyond Meat, Impossible stuff, Impossible burgers, or whatever, I consider them a fast food. Right? That's my that's my vegetarian fast food, right? But they don't comprise the majority of my diet. The principle I use is whole food, plant based. Whole food means it's closest to as it was it was growing, right? There's as little processing as possible, right? So instead of eating corn flour, cornmeal, you eat corn, right? You eat as close as possible to where it was when it got picked from the ground, right? And plant based, and you pretty much get all the nutrients you need, and you once you use that principle to guide your diet, it does require a little more effort. I have to be honest. It's not just jump up in the morning and you make a waffle or whatever. You have to just do some preparation, and it's an investment into your health. So I think it does involve that. And the thing about being a vegetarian too is that you have a lot more control over your food, because it's easier to grow lettuce or kale than it is to grow a cow, right?
Fair.
And you might look at the cow that's outside, in Switzerland, grazing. But a lot of those cows, they have to give them antibiotics because, there's a lot that goes into sometimes maintaining a cow healthy and ensuring that it reaches a particular weight. There's a lot that you don't see that happens, you know, that farm-grown meat is not as farm-grown as you might think, right? When you get into it, you realize that it's there's a lot of chemicals involved in rearing animals, and that chemical doesn't always exit them. You know, it's inside their flesh, and you still have to, you consume it, right? And you still get whatever negatives that comes along with it. Now there's fertilizer and pesticide and insecticide that comes with vegetables as well, but it's far easier for you to grow your own vegetables and plants than it is to grow animals. And I mean, you can eat from it every day. You don't have to preserve them as much as you have to preserve meat. I'm personally into what I call regenerative organic farming. That's something I do at home. I farm
at home in the U.S.
or no, in Trinidad.
Yeah,
right. I have my backyard garden, you know, and I don't farm in the typical way where you get your fertilizer and your insecticide. I apply what we call regenerative farming methods, where I actually don't till the soil. I use compost on top of the soil, because tilling the soil actually destroys the network of roots and animal homes, so to speak, under the soil.
Oh, wow.
Right? And think about our forest. Think about our rainforest. Who tills the rainforest?
Exactly.
Yeah. It's the luscious, most productive thing in the world in terms of plants and animal. But nobody tills it because it has natural tillers. The earthworms, all the insects that live on the soil, they create burrows. They aerate the soil automatically. They eat the organic matter on the top. They pull it down to the bottom. You know? And regenerative farming is about utilizing nature to create better plants and animals, create better plants and food, right? So what we do, we try to imitate nature as much as possible. And it's been used, it's a growing trend, even in industrial farming, where, you know, instead of tilling the soil, because what happens when you till the soil, you turn over and you destroy the ecosystem, right? And all the plants and insects that would live in the soil, their homes get destroyed. And the soil depends on them for conversion of nutrients for the plants. And if the plants can't get the nutrients they need, they won't produce to the quality that they need to, and they won't be strong. And when they're weak, they are more susceptible to insects. And
yeah.
You know, insects destroy them. And, you know, so it's a cycle into my vegetarianism life. You know, so I grow my food as much as I can. And I take care of my health. I'm a big 5K runner. Like, I like to run.
Oh, good for you.
You know, so I do everything I can to increase my statistic of not having, you know, lifestyle diseases, and, you know, just my best.
That is low time preference. You grow your own food. Like, so I wonder, because at the beginning you said that you've always been in an early adopter. Do you think that's the only reason sort of you gravitated towards Bitcoin? It sounds like you already have a spirit that's geared towards soundness. I think that's the word to describe it. Food, money, I'm guessing relationships, spirituality as well.
Yeah. So the way I look at life and the way I make my own decisions. I mean, I was born in a particular culture. I mean, you know, I can't choose where I was born. I can't choose my family. I can't choose my influences, at least the ones I grew up with. But there comes a point in your life where you have to question all the decisions that you make. Like, okay, why am I who I am? You know, why do I do what I do? And then I have to, there are two ways I evaluate soundness of my decisions, is to say, okay, who has been doing this? Yeah. And what outcomes have they seen? You know, are they getting positive outcomes from the decisions that they've made in the past? And, you know, what are they doing to get these outcomes? So I analyze those, you know, and I watch cultures and I watch people. And once I see, like, for example, In my family, this is a bit personal, but in my family, I've seen in my past, the men around me, most of them have been unfaithful, right? They've been, you know, marriages don't really last long in my family. Like, people, especially from the male's side, right? And I've seen how it destroyed families around me. I've seen aunts and, you know, just cousins and siblings and so on just get destroyed. And I realized that, hey, you know, faithfulness in relationships, it only works, it works if you are faithful. And if you become unfaithful, it destroys not only your relationship, but destroys generations. I've seen generations being destroyed by just unfaithfulness in a relationship. So I made a decision to say, hey, you know, this has to change with me. So I mean, I'm not out of the woods, sorry, anything is yet. But I mean, I've seen how important marriage is, and I've seen, you know, if you invest in your relationship, how that not only improves your life, but improves the lives of your children and whoever you, and the people who come in contact with, right? And you, it is scientifically proven that people who are married do better financially, and, you know, so there's a lot of positives that go, and I can observe them from science, and I can observe them from just people around me. And so I make those analysis, and I say, okay, these are decisions I need to make in order to get those benefits. So I make those decisions, and I know that they're not necessarily guaranteed, but they're statistically more likely.
Yeah.
Right. And because of the likeliness of the statistics towards making these decisions, and I, I move towards making decisions that I believe will put me in a better situation. And yeah, so far so good.
Yeah.
I try my best.
You know, it's you mentioned that at business school, in the leadership stream, we had to read a book called Hostage at the Table. I think that's what it is. And so it's a hostage negotiator speaking about hostage situations, how, I guess, you can hold yourself hostage, how you hold other people hostage. It's really like reflective, you know, forcing you to think about your own actions, your own behaviors. And one of the things that blew my mind, it was a whole process. We had to read the book. We had to write essays. We had to be very open with our experiences. And the concept of a secure base, I don't know if you've heard of that, but essentially a secure base could be a relationship. It could be your faith. It could be routines. But the strongest secure base a human can have is a relationship with another person. And so when you have a relationship, however functional or dysfunctional or however you want to qualify it, when that ruptures, your secure base is absolutely rocked, and it does take a very, very long time to recover. And the opposite of that is when you have a strong, secure base because you believe in yourself, you have confidence, you believe in the other person. So I believe in my husband, for example. You know, I've done all of the work I need to do. I don't need to go outside, whatever. I think he's the same. You're able to start flourishing and start sort of like ascending to self-actualization because you have that security at the bottom. So what you say about seeing generations being disrupted because of a breakup, it's beyond math. It's beyond statistics. It's really a human need to have a sense of attachment and security.
Yeah. It's totally. And there are certain things that you just can't, it's difficult to explain, and that's why for me I use observation in a number of them, because I don't have the science behind everything, you know, and perhaps there's no science behind some of the things that we observe. So I just look at behaviors, human behaviors around me. I'm a scientist by heart, but I've gotten in love with social science over time. It's a lot of inexplicable just behaviors happen, and they have so much impact on the world that you have to pay attention, and you have to really like look at these things and say, hey, you know, there's something behind this, and I need to follow or ensure I'm following this set of rules or this guideline or these principles to ensure that I have the best outcome. Right. And until I figure out the science behind it, because there are certain decisions I've made in my past that I never understood the science behind it. But I just saw people around me benefiting positively. But as I understood the science, it kind of cemented your belief in it. And you kind of understand, it was a good decision you made in the past, and just use that information to continue in the path that you're going right now. So, yeah. Fun stuff.
So how do you, like, this has gone off in a direction I wasn't expecting that I love, which is part of the reason, like, I love speaking to people who are into Bitcoin, because I find that the depth of the conversation is so much more nourishing, I guess is the word, than, like, the superficial stuff. But last question on this tangent, and then we'll speak about something else, and then we're going to have to wrap up. Oh, kind of soon. It's only 4:15. But how do you sort of manage the scientific aspect of yourself and the religious aspect of yourself? How do those coexist, or are they one?
Okay. So just looking at the whole concept of Bitcoin again, there is a monetary policy, right? And the monetary policy is what determines what happens in the entire the whole Bitcoin ecosystem, right? The policy says, okay, the the transactions happen this way. There's X number of Bitcoin. If you send money and the X amount of confirmations, the Bitcoin will reach to a different wallet. So there are rules that exist in every system, right? Now, you can choose to not follow the rules, right? However, it doesn't change the rules. What you choose to do doesn't impact the rules. I mean, if I say to myself, okay, I'm going to send you one Bitcoin, but you should get two. That will not change the rules, right? And, you know, me not following the rules is not beneficial to me because I don't get the best out of the system. If the system is made to operate a particular way, then it's best you kind of go along with it, right? Not being in the sense of, okay, I'm going to just follow blindly. I'm only participating in a system that I understand that it has some benefit, right? If I don't see the general outcome of the system to be beneficial, then I'll not want to participate into it, right? So I look at the outcomes first. So, if that's the outcome, what are the steps that I need to follow to obtain this outcome, right? So I look at that in that sense. And for me, that's what religion has been for me. It has been, I've seen outcomes and for thousands of years of experience of other people before me have gotten, you know, what I've considered to be pretty good outcomes from their experience. I might not follow it the same way they did because, with time, cultures and so on, different things change. I don't practice religion the same way my parents did or their parents, yeah. Right? I look what's relevant for me, but I stick to the same principles, right? I say, okay, there are some underlying principles that are practiced differently across different cultures, religions, denominations, whatever. But what are the basic principles? And for me, the most basic principle is love, right? Yeah, because we're in this world with people, and you need to love them, right? And how do I love the person beside me? How do I show love? I mean, in one era, you might show love in one way, and the next time, you might show love another way. But the base principle behind it is love. And if I'm operating my life in a way where you don't feel loved, then I might need to correct something, right? And me loving you means I'm doing everything in my strength to ensure that you're living in the best world you can live in. Right. And I mean, that's kind of what even influenced my position on Bitcoin is that I love people around me so much that I wanted to understand that this thing works. Right. And you need to understand it so you can get the benefits that I've experienced. And, you know, if I can, so that's kind of my basic principle. And for me, with religion, it has those principles encoded, where, it's not just based on how I feel about it today. You know, there are encoded principles that have worked over the ages. And if you follow these encoded principles, and taking consideration, you know, because I mean, there are people who follow religious dogma and, you know, it really destroys them and the people around them. But if the principles are based on love, there can be no destruction in love, right? There is only benefit in love. And that's just the basis of how you operate. And it extends, because love now then extends out into, you know, I won't steal from you, I won't kill you, I won't, you know, whatever the other branches of love go out in, you know, people interpret them differently and so on. But you as a human being has to evaluate, am I doing this out of love, and love with love. I mean, whether you're atheist or Christian or whatever, everybody can agree that, you know, love is a good thing. You know?
Yeah,
and it also, you know, involves putting yourself. Sometimes to love, you have to put away some of your own needs in order to love properly. Right, you have to sacrifice what will put you in a place that you think is better for the benefit of others. And in the end, it pays itself forward, because when you make others happy, it end up make you happy too, right? So it's an amazing thing. I don't fully understand. I don't claim to fully understand all of it, but it just works for me so far. that's what my measurement is, that, you know, it's so far so good. You know, I've done this and I haven't seen any negative results. And as soon as I'm aware of anything negative, you know, I try my best to improve on it. So
I have a few friends who are single. Do you have like cousins, friends? You mentioned a sister. I don't know if you have any brothers, but like other people who are like you with similar values. Because I mean, like, this is not the type of thing we see projected. Right. In mass media. Mm-hmm. And you are a very real person. So like, I mean, this is not about dating either, but if you know other people who are like you, you know,
no.
I'm going to share your Twitter handle as well. So like,
so I've always been a kind of weird guy. I ask my friends, like, I've just always been weird. I've always embraced my weirdness. Because I just always seen the benefits of it. I heard a guy made a statement. He says, he said, ensure your difference is making a difference, or else you're just weird. So I've always ensured that whatever weirdness I've had, it's a useful weirdness, right? I was into technology very early, and people, they say, it's geek, you know, it's always into computers, blah, 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 right? But I'm like, hey, Bill Gates is into computers. You guys don't see that? The guy's a billionaire because he was into computers. Like, you all should get these computers, right? Right? And, you know, so I'd analyze, you know, how people would respond to my weirdness and understand that, hey, it's not because it's not making a difference. It's just because it's different, right? And they don't, we as humans, we don't gravitate to different all the time.
Yeah,
we like to see homogeneous people around us, everybody around us doing the same thing, and we like that we can, you know, determine what you do and who you are. But yep. I don't live my life based on who is around me. You know, I remember when I got into computers, I wanted to learn to do programming, and the community I lived in, literally nobody understood anything about programming. Right? I remember this guy, he was saying, once I was in school back in the day, I learned this language, C++. I think I have some book somewhere. I pestered him for weeks trying to find that book. But he said he couldn't find it. So there's nobody around me doing the things I wanted to do. So what I ended up having to do is to find the people who are like me, right? And the people who are like me, they're on the internet, right? However, they're not all one person. Like, I'm able to pull out the characteristics out of. I could see Hitler and say, hey, Hitler was really good at farming. I really appreciate Hitler.
Let me study his technique.
Right, you know, and I just ignore the rest of him, and I'd go to everyone, and I'd find the best traits in them, and I'd just pull them out for myself, right? So that's how I find my people. You know, I use the internet. I listen podcasts, YouTube, I read books, audiobooks. I just consume a lot from the people who I want to be like. You know, especially in Tobago, it's a population of 50,000 people, right? There are probably 5 computer software developers in Tobago. Right? Most people work for the government in some administrative form, or are they entrepreneurs in their own non-tech way, right? There are not a lot of technology innovators in Tobago. But I've learned the most while living in Tobago, because that's when I kind of discovered the internet and sources of information and people doing amazing stuff. And, you know, I just kept on, you know, feeding at the fountain of knowledge and learning. And it has meant that I've changed a number of my beliefs. the way I perceive life and people and, you know, just things have changed, because I've seen people who have gotten better benefits from life than I have. And that meant, you know, there's something I needed to do. I mean, there are things still right now. I'm not where I want to be. You know, I should be in a much better place. And there are certain things in me that, you know, because of how I was cultured growing up, nobody around me was an entrepreneur. You know, everybody, you know, had 9-to-5 jobs and
safety. Right? Yeah.
And I breaking out of that is very difficult. It's really hard. And you know, there are just things that just a part of how you operate as your culture dictates it. So it's difficult to break out of it. But you know, it's a challenge and it's a daily growing process. You know, as we grow, we learn and we improve. So that's how I look at life.
Yeah. It's that for entrepreneurs, it's I think the sooner, so there's a product or service that you're working on, and there's the whole emotional aspect to manage. And sometimes, like, especially when you're really passionate, you don't think of the emotional part, but when it catches up to you, it's a lot of work to manage. And I think the sooner you can identify what you're saying, like the difference in patterns, like your personal behavioral patterns versus the patterns within your culture, the easier it is to sort of detach and start making other decisions so that you don't get like sort of stuck in these questions. Why am I doing this? Why am I like this when other people are like that? It's that's very good advice that you're bringing up for entrepreneurs, because it can be hard.
Yeah, it's terribly hard. I mean, I spent a lot of time just, I like new stuff and so on, but as I like learning, but I spent a lot of time beating up myself on knowing so much and doing nothing about it. Right? I mean, if I could convert the knowledge I have into like real hard like work, I'd probably be way ahead of where I am right now. I mean, I've read so many books, I've just consumed so much, and it's just putting that into effort and into action just sometimes so hard for me, you know, because it's just not natural for me. It's difficult. It's a hard process. I mean, I have to sit down and write lists of things to do every day to say, Rohan, you need to get this done. It's a real struggle. And people, I mean, you might see the outcomes of the stuff you do, but you don't realize that, hey, this took a whole lot of mental wrangling for me to get to this point.
Yeah.
Right? And it's not easy. You know what to do, but knowing what to do is just half the work. You have to get out there and do it.
Yeah. And set boundaries as well. For the curious mind, boundaries are very difficult because it means that you can't pursue something that is very fascinating. But in terms of, like, I guess, traditional productivity, they're very necessary. Like, there are times when I just put my phone, I'll either turn it off completely, I'll put it on do not disturb, and I will say, like, pound it out, get it done, and that's it. And then I'll have a reward at the end. I'll treat myself to something special if I dedicate like a full day or whatever the project duration is. Then I'll let go and just be like, I don't know, all day on Twitter or something, you know. But those boundaries are very important.
Yeah. And I mean, it's also good. I mean, well, I guess I really like, I'm married, so it's good when you have someone who's sometimes not exactly like you. my wife is a bit more ordered and, you know, focused. and she helps me sometimes to just kind of, you know, okay, Rohan, I know you're excited about this and whatever, but just kind of focus on getting this done. And when you have people around you who are, you know, who complement your character traits, it helps to kind of get you rounded. The type of person I was before getting married, I would just go out and just try something for 6 months and then forget about it. Try something for 6 months and get away. You know, as I said, I love to get into new things, you know, and she's totally opposite. You know, she's kind of reserved. She's, in terms of, she's not reserved, she's very outgoing and so on, but in terms of risk taking and just trying new things, she was on the other end of the scale. But she balanced me out in the sense of, okay, I'm a bit more focused now on, okay, not doing it because of it's just fun to do, doing it because, okay, this actually makes sense to do and working on it. And, you know, it's, we need people, whether it be your spouse or our friends or family, you know, we need people around us because in the end, we're social beings. And, yeah. and everything that we do is really, in the end, a social activity. You know, when you go out to make money, it's so you can build a better life for your family and your friends around you. Right? I mean,
yeah.
If I have $1 billion and I live on a mountaintop in some remote place, I wouldn't survive. Right? Social environment is quite important. I saw research that was done the other day. It was done over, it was like a multi-decade research, and it was done over a couple of decades, and they tracked just random people, thousands of random people, and they at the end they asked them throughout their life, they would give them surveys and then at the end they asked them questions and so on, and they found out that the biggest contributor to success across all the entire population of people in the survey was relationship with families, with relationship, personal relationships, right? Whether it be your family, your spouse, friends, co-workers. That's what primarily impacted their success in life. Which success included health. People who had better family, they're less likely to have heart disease and stroke and whatever. Yeah. Success in terms of just finances, success in terms of career, all that. When you have an intact social system and people around you who are, you know, care for you and you can interact with and share, it creates a better you, right?
Yep.
So whatever we do, it's really a social activity. You know, we have to ensure that we're building ourselves and we're building ourselves so we can build others.
Yep. Right? The secure base.
Exactly. Secure base.
I know that I definitely underestimated the importance of relationships at one point in my life, because I was like, I can run faster by myself. Yeah. And it's like, yeah, but you get tired. You get tired. And when you want to rest, like, what are you going to do?
Yeah. Rest. When you run and you win the race, like, you're there at the end of the finishing line and there's no one to celebrate with. Right? You know, what's the purpose of running? Right? The purpose of running so you can share whatever the benefits of running is with people around you. You know, it's not just for self. It's kind of unintuitive to think that, you know, you're doing this for yourself, but it's really you're doing it for others. And children actually bring that around, like, really like hard for you, and when you realize that, hey, you have to spend a lot more time, you know, building these people. You know, and you have to sacrifice your own personal gain to build other people, and that just changes how you think. You know, and when you think of life, you realize you're just here for a couple of decades, but your impact can influence generations down the line. I did my family tree the other day, and I realized I think I went back as far as 1830 something. And I realized, hey, they were just a few steps away. When you think of 1830, it seems like this far distance. But I looked at the family tree, it was just like just a few steps. You know, it's not as far as you might think. But the decisions they made back then totally influence who I am today. You know, and we're just here for a short time. But the decisions that we make are not only for us. I mean, even if you don't have children, you, the people you interact with on a daily basis, you know, your co-workers, your friends, your family, they get influenced by what you do today. You know, so we should optimize for making the world a better place through our influence. You know, and if you would think like that, it's a long time preference.
Yeah, exactly.
It's remarkable that at how not only better their life becomes, but how better your life becomes as well. That's the total unintuitive part about it, is that by looking outside of yourself, you build others and you build yourself by accident, so to speak, right? And you end up with a better life. You might not be as rich or, pursuing the things that everyone else sees as amazing, but it brings across things that are immeasurable. There's no science to prove them as yet, but you just feel better. And you know it's the right thing you're doing. And, I kind of like to travel along that path.
Yeah, the intangibles. Do you have children?
Yeah, I have two sons. One's 5 and one's 2.5. Yeah, they're both.
2.5? Oh, okay, so born in 2019.
19 and
16. 2.5? Yeah. My daughter just turned 2 in October on the 7th.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and I understand everything you're saying, like this, you really give of yourself so much, I breastfed for a while and it wasn't something that I thought I would ever do, but like giving of yourself in that way and seeing her grow, so after daycare, my husband and I, we really try to not be online, so we're very present. We do activities together as a family. She loves stories and stuff, so I read her a lot of books. But if she sleeps well. She doesn't usually wake up in the middle of the night, but if she does, we're there. Like, it's always giving, and somehow I feel like I've received so much more than I've actually given. Like, every time I think of her, the smile that just comes on my face, like, she can be a bit naughty sometimes because she's 2. And I can get so annoyed. And then, like, 2 minutes later, I'm just, like, admiring her and just staring at her like, wow, this little thing exists. It's amazing.
Yeah. Just to segue back a bit to Bitcoin, when you talk to people who are early in Bitcoin, they said that they would give away tens of Bitcoin, hundreds of Bitcoin to people, just saying, hey, you want to try out this new thing? Here's some Bitcoin. You had these things called Bitcoin faucets. They were just websites you'd go to, and you just get free Bitcoin, right? And they'd give out 1 Bitcoin. Like, you go to the website, and it gives you 1 Bitcoin. And it, when you think about it, if it wasn't for that generosity in the beginning, If the guy who created Bitcoin said, hey, I want all this Bitcoin for myself, and he just kept on accumulating it for themselves, nobody else would really care about it, right?
But exactly.
In the early days, it's just the generosity. They started giving out Bitcoin to everyone, and then people started to talk about it, and it became an environment, a community. And that generosity just overflowed, and that impacted the price. And the price impacted what you had, right? Just the whole thing just showed what generosity does. It's not just limited to that sphere. It's an open concept that applies across all our different aspects of our lives. That generosity, we have to just keep giving. Give sometimes giving without expectation of anything in return, right? And funny enough,
true giving.
Yeah, and funny enough, that is when you get the most, right?
Yeah.
When you give. Just knowing that someone else would benefit from what you're doing. And you love others as yourself, and you do the best for others. And it turns around, you get to get the best out of it as well. So.
Yeah.
Fun stuff.
Wow. This is such a pleasant surprise, because I didn't see this direction at all when I was just putting together the outline. But we're going to wrap it up soon. Can you, just leave the audience with tips or advice if you're just starting out in Bitcoin?
Right. So this might, I always give this advice. There are 3 things I say. Have a long-term preference. So if you're going to invest in Bitcoin, don't think about claim your profits tomorrow, right? You're going to be like me. You're going to claim 100% profit and lose out on 2,000% profits, right? So have a long-term preference. A minimum 2 years. No one has ever invested in Bitcoin for 2 years and lost. It's check the charts. with 2 years, you will definitely make a profit after 2 years, right? Two, DCA, which is dollar cost averaging. Like, you don't have to put you don't have to wait until you have $100,000 or whatever to invest in Bitcoin. You invest as little as you understand, or as much as you understand, right? And you do it often because it's a different type of asset. The price fluctuates. The market is still young, so the price still fluctuates a lot, right? So to get the best of the highs and the lows, invest. My recommendation is weekly. Put a small amount of Bitcoin every week. There are tools that allow you to do that. I mean, for the Caribbean, I don't think there are any tools available now. I'm working on one, but there are no tools available right now that allow you to DCA automatically. So you have to manually go and put in a small amount of Bitcoin every week. And you benefit from the highs and the lows. And so have a low time preference, DCA, and as I like to say, HODL. Don't spend. Like, think of this as you're trying to get a piece of digital real estate that you're getting less and less access to every year, right? It's getting more and more expensive to purchase. I mean, when I just started, I could have bought many Bitcoins, right? But I didn't because I didn't understand the gravity and what Bitcoin would be. But now I do. I try to every opportunity I get to invest in it. I told someone the other day on Twitter that the majority of my net worth is in Bitcoin, and it was intentional. I didn't start out putting out majority of my, it became the majority of my investment, my net worth, right? It grew, I just sat there and just saw it just inflating. I was like, what's going on? right. So I just left it there and it grew, right? And I don't think we're nowhere close to the end of this growth. I think we're still very early. All right. Yeah. I thought we were late when it reached $1,000. I was like, oh, I wish I got in with that when there were people buying Bitcoin for $1 and I'd be such a billionaire right now. But I mean, it's not late. If you talk to people around you, you realize how early you are. It's just still a total conundrum to the average person, right? We are still very early, and coming in just. Don't think about trying to get rich and be a multi-billionaire. Just think about having a sustainable, stable way to invest and save just for your family, right? And if you look at it that way, it's not a get-rich-quick scheme. It's not something you're going to jump in to jump out. It's a long-term investment. You're putting your assets. It's the best store of assets because... no one can confiscate it.
Yep.
It's unconfiscatable. The government, the only way people can get your Bitcoin is if the government or some scientists figure out a way to read minds.
To tap into your seed phrase,
Memorize that seed phrase in your head. And wherever you go in the world, you go to China, you go to Japan, you go to Saudi Arabia, South Africa, wherever. You have that seed phrase in your head. You have access to all your assets, right? And that is just a new paradigm that has never existed in humanity, you know. And it's hard to wrap your mind around, but just keep learning, keep understanding DCA and HODL. Once you do that, it shows its benefit over time. 2-3 years down the line, you're looking back at it now and you're like, yeah. That's all I had to do. I didn't need to understand anything else about Bitcoin. I didn't understand who's mining it. I didn't need to understand the halving cycle. I didn't need to understand none of the technical. I mean, there are lots of technicals behind Bitcoin, right? You don't need to understand any of that. You can over time, and it makes you firmer in your belief, but all you need to understand is DCA and HODL.
And HODL. And would you be, because you hinted at a solution for acquiring Bitcoin in the Caribbean, would you be willing to come back another time to speak about that more?
Yeah, I'm thinking, because right now we have to purchase Bitcoin with credit cards, which is a fee, right? And not all the platforms allow you to DCA. I'm hoping to allow people to purchase Bitcoin with Jamaican dollars or Trinidad dollars or whatever through bank transfers. And so that's a project I'm working on right now in the background. So hopefully it comes out in the future and we'll have greater access to Bitcoin in the Caribbean.
I think that would be really cool. And I think that would be very, very cool. And just if someone's listening that could help you, for example, is there something specific that you would like at this given point that you need or that you want, or like a contact somewhere? Like, is there anything that could help advance the project?
Well, I guess the laws across all the different Caribbean countries are kind of different. There are different financial services commissions and so on across the countries, and they treat these things like digital assets differently. So I guess right now I'm still kind of ignorant of the space, and I'm learning more and more about it. So if I could get people who are, deeper into it and they understand the laws and so on to share, so we can navigate them. Some of them we might have to jump over, right? Or bend in a particular way. And I mean, the regulators sometimes just want to know that you're interested in complying, and they'll make ways for you. I know, like Stripe, when Stripe just came out as a payment gateway in the US, they got a lot of leeway for certain things because they were the first person doing it, right?
And
I'm hoping that we'll be getting some of that as well as we try to bring the Caribbean up to speed with this whole revolution, financial revolution that's happening before our eyes. And that we don't fall behind, I mean, Africa right now is booming with cryptocurrency transactions.
Nigeria.
Yeah, Nigeria is like...
Even with problems with regulation.
Yeah. They have a term for Bitcoin. They say it's anti-fragile, right?
Yeah.
It's not like you can't attack it and it won't break. It's that the more you attack it, it's the stronger it gets. the more you try to ban Bitcoin, it's the deeper that the black market grows, and it creates a ecosystem that's way beyond your control. And by the time it comes out, it's so big that you cannot stop it again, right? So I'm actually, whenever I hear governments like banning Bitcoin, it makes me smile.
Like China.
How did that work out with Bitcoin mining with China?
Yeah.
All those ASICs on a plane, gone.
Yeah, they have single-handedly removed a significant part of the economy and the future economy by banning Bitcoin, right? And whoever benefits are going to have that benefit in the future. So whenever I see them a country banning it, I smile because I'm like, hey, now we know how to overcome this ban, because Bitcoin will always find a way. Always find our way around, because Bitcoin is the people. We are Bitcoin. We are Satoshi, as they said, right? It's not a system that operates on its own. It's not AI. It's people, and people will always find a way. People will always, we will overcome obstacles, and people will try to ensure that we benefit in the best way possible. And if there are obstacles in the way, we'll find a way around it. So, yeah.
Nice. Well, thank you so much for your time. And I would love to have another discussion with you, because I think I really like this. Have fun in El Salvador. I hope that you can document your experience as well.
Yeah, I'll be taking videos and stuff. So you can follow me on Twitter and you'll see me posting every day.
Yep. And your handle again for everyone on Twitter is?
Frazeres, Frazeres. Yeah, that's my name. it's like a Jamaican. My initial is Aries, Ras. Jamaicans are Rastafarians. So it's like, hey, Ras.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, Fraz Ras.
And Fraz.
You
Fraz is a kind of it's a Jamaican terminology we use. It kind of means you're high, or it means you're just kind of chill.
Yeah.
But I made up this name when I was in high school, so don't kill me for it.
Oh, no, not at all. Do you actually know Calcasa? Like, have you guys exchanged at all in online or anything?
I've seen him on Twitter, but I've never interacted with him.
You guys, when you're freaks, I know you're very busy and stuff, you should just link up with them and have a conversation, because, you speak about Ras Jamaican. That's from Ethiopia, actually. And Cal's a really cool guy with deep experience in Bitcoin. His story about leaving Ethiopia when they shut the internet off is, like, worth hearing, definitely. He's got fantastic insights and a perspective that I think is complementary to Jamaican culture. Like, the relationship between Ethiopia and Jamaica, I find to be fascinating. So, yeah, when you get a chance, reach out to him.
Stuff. Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much, Rohan, and have a good trip.
Thank you. I'll definitely be posting. So, I enjoy this conversation, and all the best for the future.
Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed this episode. It was a real pleasure to sit down and speak to Rohan, and I look forward to having him on the show again. If you have any questions or comments, you can send me an email at saidah@fosterinclusion.com. That's saidah@fosterinclusion.com. You can also follow me on my socials at Foster Inclusion. And I've actually posted my daughter's Bitcoin savings journey for you to follow. I'm obviously not revealing her stack, that is to say how many Satoshis she has, but I am sharing her returns as a percentage of US dollars so you can follow a real life example of how Bitcoin savings work. We dollar cost average weekly and updates are posted every month. To connect with Rohan, follow him on Twitter at FrazRaz. That's FrazRas. Bye!